Somebody commented to me just before we started our meeting tonight on how unusual it was to have a sermon last week on Exodus chapter 21, the subject of slavery. Well, it's going to be even more unusual tonight because we're going to look at Exodus 22, which is an even less familiar chapter. Although the topic is a little more well known, it is going to be concerned with goods, possessions, things we own. Exodus 22. However, I'd like to start with a few comments on Exodus 23, the first 8 verses of Exodus 23. Because I feel very often that people misunderstand the nature of the law of Moses. There is an impression, a widespread impression, particularly among non-Christian people, and sometimes you find it among Christian people, that somehow the law of Moses is a bit second rate, and it taught people to be vindictive. It taught people to give tit for tat. It taught revenge, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But of course, Jesus came along and then he put things right and he pointed out that the law of Moses really wasn't all that good, but he's going to show you a better way. He's going to improve the system and fix up some of the mistakes in the old system. Now, I think that really is a very great misunderstanding of the situation. There was nothing wrong with the law of Moses. From its moral point of view, it was a law which God gave for the government of society. And Jesus was not in any way opposed to the basic principles of morality and justice that were contained within that law. Take, for example, the eye for the eye and the tooth for a tooth. Now, that is given in this section of Exodus that we're considering, as in chapter 21, but you find it again in Leviticus and you find it again in Deuteronomy. And there, Moses is giving details for magistrates. When they are laying down penalties, he is saying, the penalty must be proportionate to the offence. If it's a major offence, you have a heavy penalty. If it's a minor offence, you have a light penalty. If the offence is an eye, then the penalty is an eye. But if the offence comes down to only a leg, well, then the penalty is a leg. If it comes down to, for example, a bruise or a scratch on somebody's leg, well then, the penalty is a bruise or a scratch on somebody's leg. You see, as you move through these relevant sections of the law, that it will say an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, a foot for a foot, a burn for a burn, a wound for a wound, a stripe for a stripe, a bruise for a bruise. In other words, if a person commits a major offence, such as he takes out somebody's eye, you don't punish him by a penalty as light as a bruise or a scratch. On the other hand, if a person commits only a minor offence, such as a bruise or a scratch, you don't penalise him by cutting off his leg or taking out his eye. The penalty must not be disproportionate. It must not be in excess of the offence, nor must it be too light, so as to make the law laughable. Now, that law is there in the law of Moses, and it is still the basis of law and order today. Still the basis of the system of law and order that we have inherited. And Jesus was not in any way opposed to that. What Jesus was saying was that spirit of law, which is of necessity the basis of civil justice, that spirit must not pervade the lives and attitudes of people in their person-to-person relations. If my neighbour does something wrong to me, my next-door neighbour or somebody else in the church in some way upsets me, then I'm not to go tit for tat. I am to be forgiving. Now, as far as the law is concerned, civil law, obviously you've got to have a system of proper penalties for offences. But in our personal relationships with each other, we must be forgiving. Now, we're going to see that in the New Testament and in the Old Testament, those two principles ran side by side, and Jesus was not in any way at loggerheads with the law of Moses. The passage, perhaps, that we're thinking of is the passage in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus is saying, you have heard that it was said of old, such and such and such and such, but I say unto you something else. That expression Jesus used, you have heard that it was said of old, is not the same as what is written, or the scripture says, or have you not read what was written. When Jesus refers to what is written, or to the scriptures, then of course he's referring to the Old Testament as the authoritative word of God. But in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus is not saying that. Jesus is saying, you have heard that it was said of old. He is referring to the oral traditions, the traditions that were handed down through the elders, through the scribes, the rabbis, the teachers of the law, and which had become a horrible burden, which ground the people into the ground. And the people of Jesus' time, the Jews of Jesus' time, were bogged down in this heavy burden of traditions that had been passed on to them. Now, those oral traditions had their origins in the law, and some of them still contain statements from the law, but those statements had been distorted or misapplied. However, in some cases, the statements went far beyond anything the law said, and yet the people were in bondage to these oral traditions. Jesus was not opposed to the law. Jesus was opposed to the false applications of the law that the scribes were teaching. Now, let's take a very obvious one. Jesus says in one place, "You have heard that it was said of old, 'You shall love your neighbour and hate your enemy.'" Or was it, "Love your friends and hate your enemy"? You know the one in Matthew chapter 5. I better just get it here to make sure I'm quoting it correctly. Where Jesus says, yes, "You have heard it was said, 'You shall love your neighbour and hate your enemy.'" Well, that was what was said, but you won't find that in the law of Moses. Now, you might find the part in the law of Moses, "You shall love your neighbour," but you won't find anything in the law of Moses that taught people to hate their enemies. But that was the false application the teachers had made. Now, Jesus is not introducing anything new. Jesus is simply driving them back to the law which they had distorted and neglected. And so Jesus says to them, "I say to you, not hate your enemy, but love your enemy just the same as you love your friends." And when Jesus says that, he is quoting from the law of Moses from Leviticus chapter 19. Jesus' teaching was not original, not in this area anyway. He was simply driving them back to the basics that they had forgotten. In Leviticus 19 it says, "You shall not hate your brother in your heart." Now that's in the law of Moses. In Leviticus of all places, chapter 19 verse 17, "You shall not hate your brother, not even in your heart. You shall reason with your neighbour, lest you bear sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance." The law of Moses did not teach people to take vengeance. It says specifically in Leviticus, "You shall not take vengeance or bear any grudge against the sons of your own people. You shall not even bear a grudge." That's in the law of Moses. "But you shall love your neighbour as yourself." That's what Jesus is quoting. He's quoting from Leviticus 19 where it says, "You shall love your neighbour as yourself." Now let us look at Exodus 23. In verse 4 we find the same sort of thing. "If you meet your enemy's ox or his ass going astray, you shall bring it back to him. If you see the ass of one who hates you lying under its burden, you shall refrain from leaving him with it." Don't just leave him there. "You shall help him lift it up." Now there's right in the law of Moses the same sort of teaching that you get in the New Testament, the same sort of teaching that Jesus was driving home. And what he's saying is, even though there is a system of legal justice which supervises order in society and lays down penalties for offences, you, however, must not carry that attitude in your personal relations. There is not this retributive aspect to your living. You must not be giving tit for tat. And even your enemies, you must love them. And if you see your enemy's ox lying down, well, don't just walk past. He says, help him to lift it up. But also in Exodus 23, if you go to the verses just before and just after, you find very specific references here to the execution of civil justice through the courts. Verse 1 talks about being a malicious witness, so that is something that's referring to legal proceedings. Verse 2 is a broader one, though of course the implications for legal proceedings are there as well. "You shall not follow a multitude to do evil. You shall not bear witness in a suit which turns aside after a multitude so as to pervert justice." It's very easy for Christians, as it was for God's people in Old Testament times, to be carried along by some sort of popular wave of feeling or opinion. And sometimes it might be an issue that in general direction is good. But no matter how good any scheme of man's may be, you'll inevitably find that there are some attitudes or some aspects of it that are wrong, that are evil. And we've got to be careful as Christians that we don't blindly follow something without thinking it through. We have to be objective, and we have to realise that even good plans or good people may have bad elements mixed in. And we are not to just blindly follow because we're hooked on a particular line. Our loyalty must always be to what is truth, to what is just, to what is right. And sometimes we are going to find that if we stand for that, we are going to get attacked from the left, and sometimes we'll get attacked from the right. But we must be careful, we must be discerning, we must be objective, and we must not follow a multitude, because if we do, we may find in the end that although we have started pursuing something we think is a noble goal and ideal, in the course of it we get mixed up with something that is patently wrong. He then goes on to say in verse 3 that we are not to pervert the justice due to a poor man in his suit. Well, that actually is in verse 6, you shall not pervert the justice due to the poor in his suit. But verse 3 is the other way around, you shall not be partial to a poor man in his suit. Now, can you see what's happening there? In verse 3, you are not partial to the poor or biased against the rich. In verse 6, it's the other way around, you are not partial to the rich and biased against the poor. Again, we all tend to fall into this trap. There may be some rich people who are oppressive and who live a self-indulgent lifestyle, who are power-hungry, and we rightly feel that they are obnoxious characters. But because of that, we may tend then to give our partiality where it ought not to lie, and we may be biased in an opinion, automatically favour the poor simply because they're poor, and automatically be against the rich simply because they're rich. But it may so happen that in the particular lawsuit that's under consideration, the rich man happens to be in the right. Now, he says, you're not to let your feelings be swayed because of your anti-wealth attitudes. You're not to be biased towards the poor, otherwise you might pervert justice, which is due to the rich. But in verse 6, you have the other side of the coin, where the rich very often trample the poor underfoot. They use their power, money and influence to gain their own way, and the poor have no means of obtaining the most elementary justice. So he says, you're not to be biased in favour of the rich against the poor. Even-handed justice, that's what he's talking about. Verse 7, keep from false charges, don't slay the innocent and the righteous. In other words, you've got to be discerning once again. Verse 8, you shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the officials and subverts the cause of those who are in the right. Now let's go back to chapter 22. Now that, I hope, has set the stage for our understanding now of what we're going to see in chapter 22. We have a few basics concerning the law of Moses and how it operates. And I hope also that we've seen from that chapter 23 how these two elements go together. The element of civil justice and penalties that fit the crime, you know, the old saying of the Mikado, the punishment fits the crime. Well, that's the basic understanding of the administration of justice. And yet right in the middle of that, in those verses 4 and 5, we have the attitude of love and forgiveness which God's people have got to show to each other in their day-to-day relationships. What was required of the Israelites is equally required of you and me, so that we have to live in a society where we uphold the principles of right and wrong, but yet at the same time where we do not carry a vindictive, retributive spirit into our personal relationships. So fundamentally, the law of Moses is on the same tack as Jesus was in these matters of morality and justice. Now in chapter 22, we're concerned with goods, things that we own, our possessions. I have got four categories, just for the sake of clarifying this section in the first half of chapter 22. I've got four categories of goods. And the first one is what I've called stolen goods. In verse 1, if a man steals an ox or a sheep and kills it or sells it, he shall pay 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. You see there, you have restitution plus an appropriate fine. Verse 2 is an unusual one. If a thief is found breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there shall be no blood guilt for him. But if the sun has risen upon him, there shall be blood guilt for him. Now what's that mean? First of all, we've got to realise how much electricity has changed our way of life, so that dark is turned into light for us at night time. So here we are with electricity blazing away, and we can see everything pretty well, almost as clearly as we can see in the daytime. But if you lived in a society where there was no electricity, you'd find that things were entirely different. People go to bed much earlier and they get up much earlier. They sleep and rise very much according to the sun's movements. And at night, when it's dark, it's very dark. And any light that is available through fires and torches is a very inadequate light, so that it's very easy to do things in the dark. Whereas with so much electricity and artificial light around that we have these days, it makes it much more difficult. Now, supposing there is an intruder, someone breaks into your house in those primitive conditions where dark is very dark, and to defend yourself, you're not quite sure what's happening. It may transpire that the intruder gets attacked. He might even die as a result of your defense of yourself. All right, they say, we can make allowances for that. We can understand how it happened. However, if it's in broad daylight, that's a different matter. The thief must be apprehended and handed over to the authorities. You have no excuse in broad daylight when you can see what's happening. You don't have the same sort of excuse as you have at night time where you can't see what's happening. The underlying principle here is you do not take the law into your own hands. But wherever possible, you apprehend the offender and hand him over to the appropriate authorities. So much for stolen goods. There are a few other references there, but I want to move on to verse 7, which goes through to verse 13, the second section, concerning deposited goods. Goods that are left in the care of somebody else while the owner has gone away on a trip somewhere. Verse 7, if a man delivers to his neighbour money or goods to keep, that is to look after, and it is stolen out of the man's house, then if the thief is found, he shall pay double. Well, that's fair enough. If the thief is found, the thief has to pay and make restitution and he is fined. But, verse 8, the problem. If the thief is not found, what happens now? Well, the owner of the house must come near to God to show whether or not he has put his hand to his neighbour's goods. There's a suspicion now. The man has left his, let us say, his stud ram with his neighbour while he has gone away somewhere. And when he gets back, the stud ram has gone. Now, there is a suspicion. Has there been some skullduggery going on? Has there been some dishonesty? Has the thing really been stolen? Or has the owner of the house, who was supposedly looking after this animal, really done a dirty trick and made some money for himself on the side? There's no evidence. And all they can do is come near to God, it says in verse 8, which I take it means swear an oath before God. And people took their oaths very seriously. And if the person swore before God, probably before a priest, and took this oath, declaring in the name of God that he had not been up to any dishonesty, then that oath was to be accepted. But verse 9 creates a slightly different problem. Here we have what is called a breach of trust, and it doesn't matter whether it concerns ox, ass, sheep, clothing, or any kind of thing that's lost, where either party comes along and says, this is it. There's a dispute now. One says, this is mine. The other says, no, it's mine. There's a dispute. Well, both parties come before God, and he whom God shall condemn shall pay double to his neighbour. Now, the difference here, compared to the previous case, is that in the previous case, the article had disappeared. But here, the article has not disappeared, but there is a dispute as to whether it is the real thing. Well, who owns it? Now, take again our stud ram. You leave your stud ram with me while you go away for 3 months to visit your family in some other part of the country. When you come back, I bring along the ram and I say, well, here it is, given back to you. You look at it and you say, hey, wait a minute, that's not mine. Mine had a black mark behind the ear. I can remember it quite distinctly. I say, no, not the one you left me. This is yours. And so we've got a dispute. Am I tricking him or is he tricking me? Is he really pulling this one as a swifty and trying to make out that this is not the animal, and so he hopes to get his hand on one of my animals that's better than his? Or have I played the trick on him? Have I brought him an inferior animal and I've taken his stud ram off because it's better than mine and I'm giving him an inferior one back? Who's in the right? Who's in the wrong? There's a dispute. Each one is saying, this is it. This is mine. Well, the case of both parties comes before God again, and apparently the judges had some way of deciding which person was in the right and which was in the wrong. Perhaps it was an ancient Urim and Thummim type of system where lots were cast, or there was some automatic yes or no procedure where you could find a definite yay or nay answer to a put question. Whichever way it was, we aren't told, but certainly they could find out. And again, there was a penalty for the offender. Verse 10, if a man delivers to his neighbour an ass, ox, sheep, or any beast to keep, and it dies, or is hurt, or is driven away, without anyone seeing it. Now, once again, the animal has disappeared. Not quite sure what's happened here. Has it been stolen? Has it just wandered off? Has it strayed? Or has the person sold it or even killed it or in some other way used it for himself? Complete mystery. Once again, verse 11, there's the oath. The oath before the Lord is something that was considered of great importance among God's people, because they were not to take the name of the Lord their God in vain. They were not to swear falsely in his name. Well, what do we have here? An oath from the Lord is between them, both to see whether he has not put his hand to his neighbour's property, and the owner shall accept the oath, and he shall not make restitution. But if it is stolen, then he shall make restitution. So here we're deciding whether he has been up to some hanky-panky or whether he is playing it straight and honest. You have to accept the oath. However, verse 13, if there is some evidence, then the evidence must be brought. If it is torn by beasts, let him bring it as evidence. He shall not make restitution for what has been torn. So if you brought along the carcass of the animal that had been mauled by a wild beast, then that was sufficient evidence to exonerate you. You did not have to pay any restitution. Just as an aside here, I believe that many of these laws arose out of issues that Moses had to judge, disputes that were brought before him by the people, and as Moses made the decision, that became a precedent which was then followed in future cases. And certainly that's the impression that you get from this chapter, that it is that type of setup where specific cases have now been written into the law books. If you went back to chapter 18, you'd find that it is put to us pretty well in those terms, where Moses says that when people have disputes, they come before me to inquire of God. And when they have a dispute, I decide between a man and his neighbour, and then I make them know these decisions, and these decisions are accepted as the statutes of God. That's in chapter 18. And later on, in stories in Leviticus and Numbers, you find that when certain offences have taken place, at different times it says, and they put the man in custody until the will of the Lord should be known. And then when the will of the Lord was known, that became the penalty, and so it became a precedent for future cases. So that the law did not grow up in a vacuum. It was something that grew up in the nitty-gritty of everyday personal relations, which is very typical of the Bible. The Bible doesn't set out to be a theoretical handbook of all sorts of theoretical or artificial sayings all thrown together. It's not that sort of book at all. It's a very practical book. In the New Testament, most of the writings are letters which people wrote handling problems that had arisen among individuals or in churches. It grew out of the humdrum world of interpersonal relations, of everyday experiences, and that is something of the real character of the Bible. It really rings true with that attitude, with that atmosphere of experience running right through it. In fact, this law concerning the carcass of an animal that is brought as evidence, that seems to have been a common practice among the ancient peoples. If you went back to Genesis 32, you'd find an example of it, when Laban and Jacob were having one of their tussles. Now, the two of them were bits of scoundrels, and each was trying to get at the other the whole time. And on one particular occasion, when Jacob was talking to Laban, he said, "Look, I've done the right thing by you. How about you doing the right thing by me for a change?" He said, "I've looked after all your sheep. I've put up with the heat by day and the frost by night. And when any of your animals have been torn by wild beasts, I bore the loss myself. Now, I could have brought the carcass to you and claimed compensation, but," he said, "I footed the bill. So how about you showing a little bit of consideration for me, for once?" That principle there is now enshrined in the law of Moses, that where there has been attack by a wild animal, then the carcass of the beast is to be taken as evidence. So much for deposited goods. Come to verse 14, and we here meet borrowed goods. I borrow an animal from you. I go and borrow your ox to plough my field. Now, supposing anything goes wrong and the animal is hurt, the animal is injured in the course of my using it. Well, I borrowed it from you. I have to pay for the damage. Now, that's fair enough, isn't it, when you think of it? Verse 14, if a man borrows anything of his neighbour and it is hurt or dies, the owner not being with it, then the man who borrowed it shall make full restitution. Supposing, however, I didn't borrow it, but I hired it from you. You looked upon it as a commercial transaction, and you set a fee. Then I use the animal, and once again the animal is hurt or injured. Now, in this case, I don't have to pay the compensation. You pay it because you should have included such considerations in your hiring fee. You should allow for wear and tear, depreciation, accidents, insurance policies and other overheads. That is included in the hiring price. You see the difference here? One is a simple relationship between a man and his neighbour, and we simply borrow something. But the other one is a commercial relationship. And so he says, in that case, the owner has charged you a fee, he should have allowed for those things, therefore if you hired it from him at a fee, you don't have to bear the cost. That's in verse 15. If the owner was with it, then the man who is using the animal does not make restitution because it was hired, and so it says it came for its hire. That was all included in the hiring price. Very practical, down-to-earth stuff, isn't it? That's my fourth category, incidentally. The four categories, just to recap, were stolen goods, deposited goods, borrowed goods, and hired goods. And you can see the principles of justice and honesty which prevail both in informal personal relationships between neighbours and in formal commercial relationships. In both cases, the principle of honesty and justice is followed through. Just a little aside here. You have heard, and so have I, very often people have said, or don't do business with a Christian, or don't get him to fix it up, they'll rip you off. I always go to non-Christians to get things done. We've heard that sort of thing said. And of course, I suppose that occasionally it's true. Now, I've had Christians do things for me, and in the great majority of cases, they've done excellent jobs. And they've been very kind, they've been very helpful, and they've been first rate. But every now and again, you will get the bad apple in the basket. And it's that bad apple we always remember. People tell these stories about how some Christian ripped him off. He doesn't say that for that one who ripped him off, there may have been 10 who did better than average jobs for him. But we remember the bad case, don't we? And the person who's not a Christian especially remembers it, because he already has the idea that all Christians are hypocrites and you know the sorts of things they say. We have to be very careful as Christians that we do have the highest standards, because we only have to slip up once. And it's that once that everybody's going to remember for ill against us. The law of Moses here is driving home to us some of the principles that ought to operate in our relationships with each other. This whole area of possessions is one of those areas where we have a lot of bother. In fact, I was reading only last week, I'm not sure whether I read it or whether I heard it on the radio or whether it was on the TV, I can't recall now, but it was some person who was doing some sort of survey, some sociological study, and he or she, as the case may be, came up with a figure that said round about three quarters of all marital flare-ups revolved around money or possessions. About three quarters of all domestic disputes had their origins in disputes over money or possessions. And there's no doubt that our attitude to the material things that we own is going to be one of the deciding factors in the measure of tranquility and enjoyment and peace that we enjoy in our lives. We're being told here in Exodus that we have to have a proper attitude to material things. Now let's go across to the New Testament and consider one or two things that are talked about there. We'll look at 1 Timothy chapter 6. And the first thing we ought to notice is that Christianity is not like ancient Gnosticism that said the material world is evil. Matter is not evil. The material world has been created by God for our enjoyment. And in 1 Timothy 4:4 it says, everything created by God is good. In other words, material things are good. They are not evil in themselves. Possessions are not wrong in themselves. And nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving. Wealth is not condemned in the Bible, but luxury is. It seems to me fairly consistent through the Bible that people are not condemned simply because they are rich, or simply because they have possessions or money. They are condemned if they misuse those things, if they indulge their own selfish appetites, if they live in luxury or use their wealth to trample on the rights of other people. That is condemned. Wealth is not condemned. Luxury is condemned. That is consistent in the Old Testament and in the New. You'll find it if you read through the prophets Amos, Isaiah, Micah, and so on. You'll see it from the lips of Jesus. You'll find it in some of the letters of the New Testament. James, for example, says this, "You rich," he says, "you must weep and howl because the miseries are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments are moth-eaten." You see, you've used it for yourself. You've stacked it up. You should have given it out to other people if you had it. But no, he says, your silver and gold have rusted, and their rust is going to be evidence against you. He goes on to say, you have lived on the earth in luxury and pleasure. There it is again. You see, the luxury, that's what's condemned. You fattened yourselves. It's been used for themselves. That's what's wrong. But if you look at that reference in 1 Timothy 6, verse 17, you'll see there that Paul's instruction to the rich is not that they are to become poor, walk around in bare feet and gnaw away on a piece of dry bread or something like that. He says, if you have the gift of making money and if you have riches, then he says, be thankful for it and use it for the glory of God. Give it away to help other people. Some people are gifted at making money. I'm speaking here of doing it honestly and righteously and justly. And some people are gifted, just like other people are gifted, at gardening or at music or some other pursuit. But he said, if that's the gift you have, then he says, use it by all means. Use it honestly and justly, but use it so that you can help other people, because there are an awful lot of people that are in need. In fact, the majority of people in the world are in great need. And so he says, if you have some money, then spread it around to others. Verse 17, as for the rich in this world, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on uncertain riches, but on God, who richly furnishes us with everything to enjoy. There it is again. God richly furnishes us with everything to enjoy. We aren't to be apologetic over possessions or material things. They are some of the things God has given to us so that we can enjoy life in the created world that he has given to us. But if you are blessed with these riches, he says, verse 18, do good with them. Be rich in good deeds. Be liberal and generous. Spread it out. Keep making more of the stuff so that you can give more of it away to help other people. Don't use it on yourself, but use it for others. Be liberal and generous. And in this way, he says, you are laying up for yourselves a good foundation for the future so that you can take hold of the life which is life indeed. The great danger of riches or wealth or possessions is that they tend to make us independent, so that we don't need God. Now, the majority of the people in the world don't have a lot to fall back on, and so when a crisis comes, they really are up against it. Now, most of us have catered for crises. We put some aside for a rainy day. We've got insurance investments. We've catered for our future. We've catered for our family's future. And that, again, is a perfectly biblical attitude to have. But the great danger that comes with it is that we then tend to make ourselves so safe and secure that really we manipulate God out of the picture altogether. I think once of a girl that landed on our front step in Thailand, she was a Christian, and through some unfortunate crisis that had developed in the household where she was, she had to leave. And she arrived, and all that she had was one little case, like a little school case, about 20 inches long, small, hard, cardboard-type school case, and a carton, just about a foot or so cubical, like you get tins of jam or something like that in, you get them thrown out down the supermarket, a little cardboard carton, and a plastic bag. And that was it. That was all she owned in the whole world. Carried it in two hands. A lot of people are like that, and they don't have things to fall back on, and they are very much cast upon God when these crises occur. We, of course, have insulated ourselves and protected ourselves in various ways. And once again, as I say, I don't think we are to be apologetic over that, but I do think we stand in great danger of relying upon those things instead of relying upon God. Remember Jesus speaking to that young man, and the man said, what shall I do to have eternal life? And Jesus said, go and sell what you have and give it to the poor, and you shall have eternal life. That is not a formula on how to be born again. You don't go to a person and say, give away everything you have and you'll be born again. But in this man's case, it was the thing he had to do, because he was trusting in that. And as long as he was trusting in that, he could not trust in God. That was his God. And Jesus saw, and he said, in your case, you've got to get rid of that. And until you do, you'll never find eternal life. And Jesus hit the nail right on the head. And the man didn't want to give it away. And it said the man had great possessions. He trusted them, and he went away sorrowful because he wasn't going to part with them. Here in Timothy, it says the same thing. Do not set your hopes on those uncertain riches. You must set your hope on God. And if he's giving you those riches and possessions and material blessings of one sort or another, then use it for the good of others. Spread it around so that others also might taste of some of the benefits that God intends for man through his creation. Let me conclude by reading to you words of Jesus himself. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust consume and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasure in heaven, where neither moth nor rust consumes and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also.